All right. Any leftover loose ends from the last session, the introductory session on the class formation problem? So, last time we kind of mapped out the broad terrain of the problem of class formation and the nature of the kinds of social relations that the problem of class formation invokes. And just the big punchline, the kind of central point there, is to not think of class formation as finally bringing people back into the analysis of class. That class structure is the analysis of positions, and class formation is the analysis of people actually engaged in action. That's not the way to think about it. Both class structure and class formation, both of these topic areas are concerned with both structures and people. Class structure is nothing other than a structure of social relations between real live people who are engaged in various kinds of practices. And to call it a class structure is to identify a particular character of those relations. But the relations are always between people acting in the world. They're not relations existing somehow autonomously from human beings. And same is true for class formation. And the simplest way of mapping out this contrast is that class relations talk, or class structures, are about the relations between classes, and class formations are about the relations within classes. Both sets of relations both constrain and enable practices of people, but different kinds of practices. Class formations constrain and enable the collective practices of actors engaged in struggles over class interests. Class relations define the practices of people interacting that generate those interests. In the Marxian framework, class structures generate antagonistic interests because of the domination and exploitation bound up in those relations. And class formations generate the kinds of solidarities that make struggle around those interests possible. The limiting case of class struggle is the individual forms of resistance that occur within all class structures. And one might want to call that the kind of limiting the limiting case of class formation, the atomized, individualized forms of resistance to the oppressions, dominations, and exploitation of class structures. That individualized form is the kind of limiting case. It still, I think, should be thought of, even this very limiting case, where individual slaves sabotage the work by working slowly and looking stupid, right? So the shuffling feet, docile slave is a form of resistance to slave exploitation. It's not the enthusiastic picking of cotton, it's the slow as possible picking of cotton. But even that very individualized form of resistance has a collective character, because it still requires the creation of norms and reciprocities within the exploited category to make possible that kind of sustained individual resistance. So it's never really just individualized. Nevertheless, I think it's reasonable to say, yes, there are forms of collective struggle that are much more collectively organized and combative as an organized force. That's what we most frequently refer to as class struggles. And the problem of class formation is to understand the problem of creating the kinds of relations which explain variations in those kinds of struggles. The key idea, which we'll then be exploring in this lecture, the key concept, which animates discussions of the class formation, class struggle nexus, is the concept of solidarity. Or at least that's one way of thinking about what's really in play here. Here's how I will define solidarity. Class solidarity refers to the willingness of individual members of a class to support the collective struggles of the class by bearing various kinds of individual costs or sacrifices. So solidarity at its heart, this is what I think it means, is the willingness of members of a class to support collective struggles by bearing various kinds of costs. Now, we use the term solidarity also in a slightly thinner sense to mean merely the willingness to support, even if it doesn't cost you anything to support. You know, so there's a kind of expression that's used. I feel solidarity with the struggles of the, you know, the Palestinian people, but it doesn't cost me anything. And I don't object. You know, I'm not giving you some authoritative way of using words. That's a perfectly legitimate, again, limiting case. And it's, of course, important. I mean, the feeling of empathy, solidarity in the sense of a purely emotional or intellectual connection of support without any demands on the person who's giving that support, nevertheless is, of course, an ingredient of the more full-fledged solidarity. It's unlikely that people willingly make sacrifices for collective struggles without feeling that kind of ideological or intellectual or emotional support as well. But the key problem of solidarity with respect to class struggle is not just the sentiment of solidarity, but it's the willingness to make sacrifices for collective struggles. This is the way that Jan Elster understands solidarity, and I think he's right for me. That's a very productive way of thinking about it. What I want to do here is play out that idea through the language of game theory, which I think is a very useful way of giving precision to the notion of willingness to make sacrifices for a collective struggle. And the device for doing that is the famous free rider problem. Now, although it's familiar to everybody, I assume, this, you know, it's unlikely that somebody would wander into this class and never have encountered the collective action problem, free rider problem, before as a formal kind of issue. Still, I think it's useful just to go through it one more time and to give it some slightly different tweaks the way Jan Elster does. So first, let's just go through the conventional story. This is Roman numeral 1.1, the formal structure of the free rider problem. The free rider problem, understood in this context, is also what's called a collective action problem. Collective action is problematic whenever, for each participant, there is a cost of participating, while the result of the collective action, if successful, is a public good which they can enjoy, even if they hadn't participated. Right? So that's the problem. You have a context where people are called upon to participate. Participation is costly. If it wasn't costly, there wouldn't be an issue. So there's some kind of sacrifice, some kind of cost, which is experienced as a cost. If it's not, if there are some things which might look like costs, but they're not experienced as a cost, then it's also not a collective action problem. So people are called upon, they're asked, join us in the strike, join us in the struggle, or even vote for this candidate. And there's some kind of cost involved. Voting requires, if it's a cold, blustery November day, and there's long lines at the voting booth, at the polling place, requires an hour of your time and some effort. So the cost can be minimal or the cost can be huge. You're being asked to risk your jobs by going out on strike. So there has to be a cost. The collective action has to have the character that if it succeeds, you will have benefits, even if you didn't participate. So some things which may have costs also give you no benefit unless you participate. Well, then that's a simple matter. You just say, is the benefit more than the cost? If it is, it's worth participating. So it costs you something to join a soccer team and take the time out to travel to another city to play your game. That's a cost. But the benefit of playing, the enjoyment, the comradeship, the athleticism and all that, comes only if you participate. if it doesn't come if you don't participate. So that's a simple rational choice problem. It's not a strategic game problem then. Do I enjoy soccer enough to pay the fees and join the team? Yes or no? If the answer is yes, you do it. If the answer is no, probably you don't do it. It's crucial then for collective action problems that if it succeeds, you get the benefits even if you don't participate. Now, the economists then always wonder, well, why does anybody ever participate in something which, if it succeeds, they get the benefit even if they don't participate, and it's costly to participate. You know, a simple cost-benefit analysis says you never participate under those conditions. And yet we observe people participating all the time. That's why it's a free rider problem, why there's a problem about it. The formal structure of the game is represented by this 2x2 table. Each person is making a choice to cooperate or not to cooperate. The word defect is used. So to defect is to not participate in the collective action, whatever it might be. And everybody else faces the same choice. So everybody is like you. It's not that everybody else is a robot and you're a free agent. Either everybody is a robot or everybody's a free agent, so to speak. But everybody has the same kind of choices. One choice is that everybody cooperates, and then you get a big collective action. And of course, its probability of success goes up if everybody cooperates. Another possibility is that nobody cooperates. Well, if that happens, the collective action doesn't even occur. Another possibility is that everybody else cooperates and you don't. Everybody else goes on strike and you don't. So you keep your wages during the strike, and if the strike wins, you get a pay raise. And another possibility is that everybody else defects and you're the sole cooperator. Right now, if you are acting on purely selfish, rational terms, you're not making any mistakes of rationality. That is, it's not that you've miscalculated or that you have faulty information. You know the payoff structure and you know how to calculate it. If you're acting selfishly and rationally, then, and all you care about is your own personal payoff, your preferred outcome is B, that is, you would like everybody else to cooperate except for you. You'd like everybody else to vote for your candidate and stand in line, and you stay home in your warm, cozy kitchen. You'd like everybody else to risk their lives on the barricades to overthrow the tyrant, and you stay home and not take the risk. You'd like everybody else to go on strike except you, right? So that's B. That's the I defect and everybody else cooperates. Your second preferred choice is that everybody cooperates. That is, you really do care about this collective action succeeding. It really does matter for you. It's definitely improves your life more than the costs if it succeeds. So your second preference is A. The third preference is that everybody doesn't cooperate. That's D. And the worst thing is for you alone to cooperate, for you alone to go out on strike and nobody else to go on strike. For, so to speak, for you alone to appear at the barricade at the appointed time and nobody else to show up. That preference ordering, B, A, D, C, that's referred to as the prisoner's dilemma preference ordering or the free rider preference ordering. That's the preference ordering under the conditions of this game when everybody is acting rationally and selfishly. That preference ordering defines three quantities. First, there's the gain from cooperation. That's the difference between what the individual gets if everyone cooperates versus everyone abstains. So if everyone cooperates, the strike has a high probability of succeeding. If everybody abstains, you stay with your present wages. the difference between A and D is called the gain from cooperation. B minus A is the gain from free riding. That's how much you personally gain if everybody else cooperates. And D minus C is the sucker penalty. That's how much you lose by being the sole person to take the risk and to engage in the collective action. Yeah.
So if the preference ordering is assuming kind of the level of the individual being rational and selfish, why is it that BA would be preferred over DC, right? If it's really based on each individual, wouldn't everyone have that self-interest to protect?
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody does. Okay. So this is each individual, but if everybody has this preference ordering, you end up with D. Right? That's why it's this paradox. Everybody prefers A to D. Everybody prefers universal cooperation to universal defection. But since everybody individually prefers individual defection, if everybody prefers individual defection, you get collective defection, even though everybody would have preferred to have universally cooperated. And that's why this is a paradox. And it's a pretty deep paradox. I don't, it can't be just dismissed as an economist's trick. This is a serious paradox, and it's one of the reasons why lots of collective action that if they had taken place would have succeeded don't take place. There are many contexts where you could say, if you could snap your fingers and get everybody who would benefit from challenging the system to do so, they would succeed in challenging the system. But instead, nothing happens. And one of the reasons for that, one way of thinking about the reason for that is each individual is making this kind of calculation. What's in it for me? Aha, it's better for me to stay home and not take the risks if everybody else does, but everybody says that, so nobody takes the risks. Yeah.
Does this model also incorporate maybe interpersonal relations? Like, if I'm the sole free rider and the movement succeeds, and everybody's angry at me, and I suffer socially?
So, in this first formulation, it ignores all those things. That would be one of the solutions. Now, how should we think about that solution? If the movement succeeds, everybody's going to be mad at me. What does that do to this problem? The everybody being mad at me, what does that do to this matrix? Yeah.
I would say, depending on how much you care about that, it would be a reason to participate.
But you have to say that more precisely in terms of the language of the cost-benefit analysis of does it pay or not.
Okay, if the cost of everybody being angry is high enough to make it a benefit for me to participate.
Right. So that means is that there are sanctions available to other people that they can impose on you, which raise your costs of not participating. And that actually, what that does is it changes this preference ordering. That is, it's no longer the case that individual defection, the gain from free riding, B minus A, goes down and may disappear if there are additional costs to defecting. Right? So what you've said is that there are in the initial problem, the BADC preference ordering assumed that there were no costs to defecting. There were only costs to participating. And now you've indicated there may be, because of social norms, because of shunning and shaming, because of other kinds of sanctions, bricks thrown through your window is another sanction.
But would those only be sanctions assuming that the movement succeeds? Because if the movement fails, then you look like a genius. Like, oh, I knew that this was going to work, so I stayed home.
Well, typically... Yeah, go on.
Only with blaming you, then. Only two more people like you hadn't defected. So it's still not you.
Yeah.
The move... movements take time too. Just think about real world examples where your mechanism would be in play. So think about a strike with strike breakers and picket lines that goes on and on and on, you know, or for some period of time. So what happens to the people who cross the picket line? Yeah.
I mean, they're shunned, I assume. I mean, like, no one really speaks from after
right.
that.
And, you know, for some period of time. You know, it, of course, it sometimes it can be horrendous. They don't just get shunned, they get beat up. And sometimes the shunning means they're completely pushed out of the community. Other times, people are just pissed at them for a few months and then life gets back to normal. And so you get the full gradation. But all of those are cases, they don't just happen afterwards. They happen in the process of collective action formation. Raising, so one way to do this, one way to solve this problem is to raise the costs of defection. Now, before we get to that, just let me then point out, what we've done now, we've begun what's going to be a more extended conversation about how in practice social movements, class formations, deal with this problem. But that only makes sense if you think it is a problem. Which I, you know, strongly encourage you to see. To say it's a problem doesn't mean it's always the central issue in a collective action. It's not always the case that the big problem you have to face is the unwillingness of people to participate. So we're not, this is not making an empirical claim that actually people are always selfish and rational, and therefore that's what has to be overcome. Remember, this is a heuristic model. What we often observe in social movements is deep and pervasive commitments and a refusal of most people to defect and a willingness to make sacrifices. So as an empirical description, the free rider problem is just wrong for those cases. What the theoretical model, though, helps you appreciate is the ways in which it's wrong, and the ways in which it's wrong is explanatory for the character of the social movement. And it also draws your attention to the things which may erode those successes, which may make over time the forms of cohesion that avoid the free rider problem, over time those can deteriorate, so that the free rider problem can sometimes emerge in the middle of a movement rather than at the starting point of a movement. Any other initial questions? We're going to go through a whole series of ways of thinking about solutions in a moment. Now, just to get it out of the way, although I don't think it's probably such a relevant point now, this was a very relevant point in earlier years when I taught, well, particularly when I began teaching this course, where lots of people invoke the notion of collective interests as solving the problem. That is, if you take the working class as an agent, as opposed to the individual persons who make up the working class, and therefore there's a problematic collective agent. But if you see classes as aggregates, as actors, then you could say, well, the reason why workers struggle is because it's in the class's interest for them to struggle. And you attribute interests to the aggregate, and at the aggregate level, there is no cost-benefit problem here. That is, at the aggregate level, it's clearly in the aggregate interests for there to be collective organization and struggle. And if you look at the aggregate costs and the aggregate interests, the aggregate benefits are greater than the aggregate costs. And so, in an ordinary, simple, rational choice situation, just like for a person, if it's in your own individual benefit being greater than cost to do something, you're likely to do it. Some people used to argue, well, because it's in the class's collective interest to struggle, because there's a collective benefit, then there's no free rider problem. That's a false solution to the problem. It begs the question, since individuals do make choices to participate or not in struggles, and this needs explaining. It just simply avoids the question. By the way, I want to make a little editorial comment since I use the expression begs the question. This is one of my pet peeves in modern discourse. So there is this expression, begs the question, which is a fantastically useful but now degraded expression. The way it's now used, it means just asks the question. This begs the question means this, I'm begging you to ask this question, right? That's not what the expression begs the question means. Begs the question means avoids the question by assuming the conclusion and framing it as if it was an answer. You know, so you assume the thing you're trying to prove. That's begging the question. You'll see it now in news, even in the New York Times. I've seen the expression, you know, somebody talks about a problem and they say, this begs the question, meaning this poses the next question. And that has basically destroyed the usefulness of that classical logical flaw. That is, begs the question is a way of identifying a logical flaw in a person's argument. You've begged the question means you've avoided the real question by pretending to have an answer where you've had to assume the answer to give the answer. That's what begs the question means. But alas, our language has lost. I think it may be a permanent loss. It'll be hard, I think, to restore that meaning, because if you use it in the correct way and a person doesn't realize, the reader doesn't know that correct usage, it's going to seem weird, because you're not posing the question, you're criticizing somebody for incorrectly identifying an answer.
You should correct people, you should write an op-ed or something.
I'm publicizing collective opposition. Yeah, there's a collective action problem. There. Oh man. So it's at least it's on the podcast now. for the six people in some distant place who listen to it. Yeah.
A simple sentence for the false solution is the attribution of collective action to aggregate, of individual action to aggregate interest.
Right. Okay. It's treating the collectivity as if it were an individual agent. You know, so this is a general problem in macro and micro discussions. We have lots of instances where we attribute agency to collective entities. So we often talk about the state does something, or Apple adopted a new strategy, right? So corporations are collective organizations. They do things in the world, but the process by which they come to do things is not some entity called the corporation acting. It's the top executives and investors meeting and discussing and figuring out what to do and then deciding that that's what the corporation's going to do. So it's a shorthand for an internal process where all sorts of scheming and back and forthing and individual managers thinking about what's good for their careers and what's good for the share owner. You know, there's all this conflict going on to decide what the corporation is going to do, which can be properly summarized. I don't object to the summary statement, Apple decided. But Apple doesn't decide things. It's not it's not a organism that has a brain. It has lots of people in it, and they collectively, through some process, decide. And there can be, within corporations, collective action failures. There can be problems of risk-taking and whatever that have this same kind of character. So unions, you can't say that the union went on strike because it was in the interests of the union to go on strike. That's simply too clumsy a shorthand. You could say the union went on strike because the leadership got together and weighed costs and benefits and figured that they could get the members to go along with this. You know, you can give a much more extended discussion and then say, and we'll summarize that by saying the union. Right. So the false solution is to imagine that you've eliminated the free rider problem by correctly identifying what's in the interests of the aggregate and treating it as if it was a person. This is also, of course, one of the reasons, among many others, why treating corporations as persons doesn't make sense. You know, but this is not the main objection to that treatment. Okay. Once you really come to accept this idea that you can't explain a collective action by the interests of the collectivity as such, it has to be, the explanation has to somehow or other bridge the problem of the interests of the individual persons who make up that collectivity and the process by which they come to coordinate their activities. That's the problem that has to be solved. Once you realize that, then you're in the world of game theory and the collective action problem. Elster gives, I think, a particularly clear-headed way of thinking about this problem and how to proceed. The task is to explain why individuals decide to participate in struggles in spite of the fact that the material payoffs are the way they're illustrated in this diagram. What he suggests then is a kind of procedure. So this is a methodological point, not a substantive one. He gives you a procedure, a series of steps to go through in building an explanation of any given collective action. He says, and this is a quote from Making Sense of Marx, page 359, first assume that behavior is both rational and self-interested. If this does not work, assume at least rationality. Only if this is unsuccessful should one assume that individual participation in collective action is irrational. So this is just this is not saying that, in fact, people are usually rational and selfish, and rarely irrational. It could be that most of the time people are acting irrationally. Could be. All he's saying is that the steps by which you do an analysis is begin with the simplest formulation. It's the simplest stripped down formulation is that people are rational and self-interested. Then let's relax the self-interest assumption. Let's assume that people have motives other than self-interest, but they're still rational. And then let's relax the rationality assumption. Yeah.
What about the idea that someone can believe that they're doing, or that they're performing the most rational action out of the set of alternatives, but it may not be, in objective terms, the most rational decision?
So that would be relaxing the rational assumption, because it would say they're acting under imperfect information, let's say. So there'd be more than one way to relax the rationality assumption. One is, they have cognitive failures. They're vulnerable to wishful thinking or magical thinking. An example of magical thinking, for this would be just as an illustration. If you ask people why they voted, given that the election for president, for a big election, given that they know that one vote isn't going to decide the election, so why did you vote? A common answer is something along the following lines. Well, if people like me don't vote, then the candidate I prefer isn't going to get elected. And therefore I voted. Now, that's kind of magical thinking, because it implies that your voting has anything to do with whether or not it will be the case that people like you will vote. And it's not true. You know, whether or not you vote isn't going to have any effect on whether other people like you vote. But there's this feeling like, if I vote, then other people who share my views are going to be voting, because I will be proof that that's the way they're voting. It's almost like the Calvinist in the Weber view of predestination. God has decided ahead of time that I'm either doomed or saved, and it has nothing to do with my behavior. But if I'm successful, that will be proof that God must have been on my side, and therefore I'm going to work really hard to be successful, because that's going to show that I've actually been selected to go to heaven. You know, this kind of this circular thinking, which doesn't really fit to any rational cognitive process, yeah.
You don't think that when people say that, it's just simply shorthand for saying, I recognize that if everybody just opted out of voting, nobody would, you know, the person I want wouldn't get elected? Because it's...
But why does that... I recognize that if everybody opted out, he wouldn't get elected, but why should I vote anyway? Because it's not going to make any difference. See, you still, there needs to be an additional element for that act, the conclusion from that to be that therefore I'm going to vote.
Would the answer then be a desire not to be blamed for the action that didn't bring about your desired result?
Well, that's assuming that other people, could be that you feel that other people are going to observe you voting, and therefore you'll be blamed.
Well, I'm thinking more of just like the clean conscience.
Well, that's a...
You know, I just don't want to feel guilty about not having done this.
So if it's guilt, then you're invoking a whole different mechanism. That is, we are moral actors. We believe we have obligations. And we believe it's wrong to be a free rider. That means that you actually have a different preference ordering. That's saying, no, it's not the case that my preference ordering is... That's relaxing the selfishness, self-interest constraint. Because it's saying, I'm not just interested in the cost benefits to me. That's not the way I calculate my decisions about how to act. I'm a moral actor, and I will calculate my positions on what I should do by what I ought to do. I'm a Kantian. I believe that I have a moral responsibility to do what I want other people to do. What that's saying is that my preference ordering is A, B, D, C, rather than B, A, D, C. That's what's called, and we'll see why in a moment, the assurance game preference rather than the prisoner's dilemma. Yeah?
Two more small points. The first one is, number three, the collective action with irrational agents. Is that irrational self-interested or non-self-interested?
Well, it could be either way. It could be self-interested and irrational, or it could be altruistic and irrational.
And my second question is, your answer to Sundar's point was that people may not have perfect information, and that would make them irrational even if they think they're being rational. So then are there really truly rational characters? Because it seems to me in the real world it's really difficult to gather all of the sufficient information necessary to make a rational...
Right, so the most sophisticated versions of these arguments talk about bounded rationality, rational enough, right? So the information problem has become recognized as absolutely pivotal. It's a relatively recent innovation in economics to talk about information asymmetries and information failures. Some economists incorrectly believe that once you recognize that there are these information problems, you just need small tweaks to economics to deal with it. In fact, what you need to deal with failures of information is sociology. I mean, one way of thinking, this isn't too much of a simplification. If the world had information transparency of the sort that neoclassical economists used to assume, then economics would be a general social science. A lot of what sociology is all about would become very marginal if there was perfect information in people's actions. And the door is open for sociology precisely because we live in a world where we are constantly faced with social interactions where we don't know what other people's motives are. We don't know exactly what's going on. We don't have all this information. And therefore, there is scope for norms and habits and social conventions, as well as all sorts of other mechanisms to be operating to regulate behavior, which wouldn't be in place if everything was completely transparent. Everything would be just a whole different kind of social environment for individual action. So one way of understanding this imperfect information problem is that once you realize you can't just wave your hands and make it go away, then it demotes economics to just one among a variety of approaches to studying problems rather than gives it this privileged status which economists still like to think they have. Joseph Stiglitz has said this. I mean, Stiglitz, who is the economist whom I think is most known for having introduced the imperfect information problem into economics, he has acknowledged that once you really take that seriously, then you need a theory of institutions and norms and culture and all these things, which economists have basically nothing to say about. Or when they say things about it, they're just repeating what sociologists and anthropologists and other social sciences have talked about. Other questions at this point? Yeah.
So you said that reducing, or that the norm of what ought to be done can remove the selfishness aspect, but the rationality remains. So then do norms get in this framework, get translated into cost and benefits? So I weigh the norm of what I think I ought to do versus the cost of losing my wages?
No, there are different strategies for incorporating norms into an analysis. One is to just package it in utility maximizing. That's the way economists like to do it. But you can maintain the rationality notion without having that solution. Because rationality simply says, given what I ought to do, what's the best way of doing it? So given that I want us to win the strike, what's the best way for us to go about it? And you can act irrationally. You can think, given that I want to win the strike, the best thing to do is to burn down the house of the owner. And it turns out that's a really stupid thing to do because it completely undercuts all the popular support for your strike. It brings the full weight of the repressive apparatus down on you and everybody's in jail and you lose the strike. So that is acting irrationally with respect to the norm of collective solidarity for purposes of realizing certain values and obligations. So the fact that you have as part of your action framework, moral obligation, rather than just self-interest, can be represented, I think, badly by saying moral obligation just means you're wanting to avoid guilt, and guilt is a cost. And I don't think that's a psychologically meaningful way of representing moral obligation, that you're just avoiding guilt costs. And there's, you can do some thought experiments, I think, that makes it clear. I mean, maybe it's worth my just mentioning this, since this comes up in discussions you're undoubtedly having with libertarian friends or others. Okay, so here's a little test case. Most people have a moral understanding that they shouldn't cheat on exams. Some people cheat anyway, but lots of people will not cheat because they think it's wrong to cheat. They won't steal from a store because they think it's wrong to steal, even if they know they can get away with it. So the guilt fine, people say, well, the reason you don't steal is because you're going to feel guilty if you steal. And the guilt is too big a cost to make up for the pleasures of whatever it is you stole. So that's the guilt fine version. So just imagine the following little experiment. You're in a store. You are 100% guaranteed you're not going to be caught for stealing this thing. And you have a little guilt-free pill that you can take. So you know that if you take the pill, you will think that you bought the thing. So you'll have no guilt. Or if you take the cheating pill, you're in an exam, you care about the exam, it matters, or you're in a sporting event. You can take this guilt-free pill, and you know that the best athlete's going to trip and you're going to win the race. Now, there are lots of athletes who would not want to win if their winning was that they would have agency in somebody else tripping, because they only want to win if they win fairly. There are athletes who will gladly take the pill and trip. There are people who would not even need to take the pill. They wouldn't feel guilty at all. We know there's a lot of... But there's plenty of people who will feel, no, even if I will have no... If I will have no knowledge of the fact, because I will take the guilt pill, the guilt neutralizing pill. So at the point of the decision, you have to do two things. You have to will the person to trip, and you take the pill, and then you win, and think that you had nothing to do with it. Some people will take the pill and some people not. If you just think about it, and you can always think of examples in your introspectively, of situations where you wouldn't take the guilt-neutralizing pill in order to get something that you'd like, but under conditions which you would otherwise feel is immoral. Yeah.
And in addition to that, like, I think even the fact that people can feel guilt about things even that they don't necessarily have any agency in, like survivor's guilt and things like that.
Right.
Like, that proves that it's not some intrinsic moral factor in rational decision.
Well, sure, and that survivor's guilt is a non-rational response, for sure. But I'm trying to, what I'm arguing here is that moral sentiments are real. They're not inconsistent with rationality, because given that you have these moral preferences, you still want to accomplish them. You know, you want to do them, you want to realize them through your actions in an effective way. So you still have a rational choice to make. What should I do, given that I have these moral preferences? But the calculus is not cost and benefit to me. That's just that's not the process by which you make your rational choice. The process is, what's the most effective way to do it with the least costs for the collectivity that's part of the moral agency involved? Yeah.
So, I mean, when an actor chooses to do something, would it be rational only after the fact of whether or not the consequences of that action were in the interest that they... So I'm like, can something, burning down the house of the owner of the factory, if that were the case, that doing that actually for some reason, you know, like, benefited the entire...
Right, so there's that raises other issues about prospective versus retrospective rationality. When we're talking about rational action, it's prospective that's the issue. Because there's all sorts of contingent reasons that something could turn out to have been a good decision, even if it was a really stupid decision at the time it was made, given all the relevant information that one had and the probable effects. So it is true that, you know, it's irrational for somebody to believe, somebody who's poor, that by playing the lottery every week and depriving their family of some needed nutrition, that this is going to get them out of poverty. But some people who do that will get out of poverty. That doesn't make it rational. It's, in terms of the probabilities involved, it's an irrational use of one's resources as a strategy for getting out of poverty, you know, making life better for you and your family. And I think it's not, I think it's appropriate to say it's irrational to think that somebody who believes that playing the lottery is a rational way of allocating resources when they have very limited resources, that they are acting irrationally. They're miscalculating the effects of their actions. Even though, after the fact, 1 in 100 million, or whatever, you know, whatever the probabilities are for winning the Powerball. And the irony, you know, in lotteries, the bigger the jackpot, the more people will buy lottery tickets for it. Even though their expected earnings go down, that is, your expected winnings for a smaller jackpot are much higher than for these mega things, where the expected winnings become even lower, and yet more and more people do it. And that's, I think that's a form of irrationality. It shows that people live in have kind of fantasy lives that motivate their actions rather than cost benefits. So rationality just means the real cost benefit analysis of the probabilities of the payoffs. Okay. Let's look then at solutions to the free rider problem. So we got this theoretical problem, and let's see how we can get collective action. What we observe in the world is that there's lots of collective action. We also, by the way, we observe, if you're a good analyst, you observe in the world many collective actions that you think should happen because it would be good for the people, the relevant constituencies, if they did happen, which don't happen. So we have two kinds of explanatory problems here. We're explaining things that don't happen. How do we explain the collective actions that don't appear? But also, how do we explain the ones that do appear? That's a pretty tough research agenda. Explaining non-events is always a tricky problem. So we have the free rider problem in collective actions. The first solution is to think about the ways in which you can actually get collective actions even if everybody's rational and selfish. So how, given the payoff matrix above, how can we get collective action if each individual is entirely selfish? They only are thinking about the material payoffs for themselves. That's the only thing that's entering into their calculus. And they're perfectly rational. They're not making mistakes. How do you get collective action with perfectly selfish, perfectly rational actors? The suggestions from the class. What's the... Elster proposes a particular solution. Michael or Sudar.
Well, it seems to me so in a rational, selfish actor situation, basically the defining characteristic is that individual self-interest trumps social self-interest, right? Or the idea of individual versus aggregates is like the distinguishing feature, right? That my decision, if I base it off of my individual self-interest, while it may be more in my interest to act in solidarity with others, given that others act in solidarity, I still choose to defect.
No, it's not more, even if everybody else acts in solidarity, it's still in your interest to defect. It's not more in your interest to be solidary.
Oh, right.
Right, so we're dealing with the purely selfish case. Yeah.
I think what Olson originally says the solution to this is like the notion of selective incentives. Like, isolating those people that they think are going to defect and giving them particular types of incentives to join the collective action.
Okay, so selective incentives changes the payoff matrix, but it poses all sorts of additional problems, because how do you create the incentives for the selective incentives? There's a different kind of solution which Elster points to, which doesn't in any way change the payoff matrix. It's still the same cost-benefit thing. Yeah?
Allow communication between the actors so that the actor and the other person
hear. So allowing communication. Well, allowing communication doesn't solve the problem, because you can communicate all the way you want, and the other person says they'll cooperate, and then you defect, because it's still better for you to defect. So allowing communication isn't... If the interests, the actors are solely motivated by self-interest, in the prisoner's dilemma, you can allow these guys to talk to each other. Still, if they're selfish and rational, they're going to defect. Yeah?
I mean, was it... Like Shippy's point about the sanctions, then, if you iterate it, was it the iterated game? Where
yeah, the iterated game.
Yeah.
So the iterated game, so the simple prisoner's dilemma is a one-shot game. You make one decision. So you only have to have a strategy for one choice. But let's suppose you're going to play this game time and time and time again. So you have to have a strategy across games, not just within games. You have to decide what are you going to do, not just now, but what are you going to do in the next game, given what you did this game and what the other players did this game. So your strategy has to span a series of games. And then the question is, what's the strategy that's in your best interests? You still don't give a shit about anybody else. You're still just in it for yourself. Still, you have to think of what's the best strategy that's going to maximize my payoff. Yeah.
Is this assuming if, say, in the first round you defect, then you no longer play, or like
no.
That happens? Or
you defect the first time, then you play the game again. You can defect the second time. So one strategy is I'm going to defect across all games. That's a strategy. But the other person has a strategy too. You know, the people you're playing against. So let me give you an example. Maybe we'll make this clear. It's a very nice book. I recommend that you, it's something that can be on your long list of things you should eventually read because it's a classic and very clear and totally engaging. It's called On Cooperation by Axelrod is the author. Very interesting book. So Axelrod did the following experiment. He contacted 100 game theorists. So these are experts in game theory. This is what they're academics. They work on these models. They're the experts. And he asks them to play a tournament with each other, a game theory tournament. And a game theory tournament means the following. You ask each to submit a strategy for a prisoner's dilemma that's played over many, many iterations. So your total payoff depends upon your payoff over the full life of the game, not your payoff on any individual game. So here are some strategies that you could have. An example is tit for tat. All right, that's a common schoolyard strategy. I'll cooperate with you. If you don't cooperate with me, then I won't cooperate with you the next game. Right? So it's retaliation, basically. So you cooperate the first round. If the person you're playing against cooperates, then you cooperate the second round. If they defect in the second round, then you defect in the third round. And then you cooperate again. So you just retaliate for one round. That's tit for tat. Another strategy is two tits for one tat, right? That is, you cooperate. If they defect, then you'll defect for the next two rounds before you'll start cooperating again. That's imposing a harsher sanction on the opponent. Or you could cooperate in every round. You could just be the universal cooperator. Or you could be the universal defector. Right? There's all sorts of strategies, right? And then the trick is everybody announces their strategy, and then what Axelrod did with computer simulations is have each strategy play all the other strategies. So universal defection played against universal cooperation gets a huge payoff, right? Because that means in each game the other person is cooperating and you're reaping the free rider game. So in a world where there are universal cooperators, the universal defector does really well. But the universal defector has to play against all the other games, all the other strategies, not just universal cooperation. So he had these 100 fancy schmancy mathematical game theorists all submit their preferred strategy for an iterated prisoner's dilemma. The founder of game theory, Anatole Rapoport, he is one of the founding figures. He submitted the simplest rule, the simplest strategy, tit for tat. He submitted that strategy. Now, against some of the individual other strategies, tit for tat didn't do well. But overall, across all of the possible other strategies submitted, tit for tat won most of the tournaments. It was the best strategy, the simple tit-for-tat strategy. Then what Axelrod did is gave these results to all the game theorists. So they saw these results, and they could change their strategies in light of how they saw the outcomes of the first round. And again, everybody submitted really complicated strategies now, you know, tit-for-tat-tat, tit-tit, or whatever. The tit-for-tat metaphor gets a little hard to say without embarrassment in a public forum. Okay, so they submitted all sorts of fancy strategies. Rapoport again submitted tit for tat, and he won the second time around. Now, that was an interesting part of the book, is sort of laying out the results of these, what they call game theory tournaments, simulating different strategies that people could have in the world if they face these kinds of collective action or free rider problems. But what it showed is that there is a strategy which gives you a payoff. If tit-for-tat plays against tit-for-tat, you get cooperation. Because they both cooperate the first time, and they'll cooperate the second time, and they keep cooperating until somebody defects. So if everybody acts in an iterated prisoner's dilemma as tit-for-tatters, you get cooperation. One of the examples he gives, in a real-world example, is the famous Christmas truce in World War I on the Western Front. So what happened on the Western Front is that the soldiers stopped shooting at each other. They shot above each other's heads, and they would only shoot at each other if the other side shot at them. So the soldiers who were in the trenches basically started playing tit for tat. They were cooperating with each other because the mutual cooperation was obviously better than the universal defection, right? And the tit for tat rule meant that individuals didn't defect to start shooting at each other. Well, the officer corps behind the lines, the generals, didn't like this. So one of the things they did is they started increasing the rotation of new soldiers onto the front who hadn't learned the new rules of the game. And that, of course, would disrupt the tit-for-tat procedures. They also started executing their own soldiers for refusing to fire at the enemy. You know, so they started treating as cowardice, which was a capital offense in the trenches in World War I. If you didn't shoot at the enemy, if you shot above them, if you were caught doing that. So, you know, what happened was the soldiers in the front lines began to spontaneously cooperate with each other in an iterated prisoner's dilemma, using tit for tat. And then the army had to disrupt that cooperation in order to keep the combat going. And that's collective action with rational self-interests. Are there follow-up questions on that, and then we'll take our break. The iterated prisoner's dilemma is an important idea when you think about it, that even if you're selfish and you know you're going to be interacting with somebody over time, and you see that the payoffs, you know about the prisoner's dilemma, you realize that what you do now is going to affect what they do later. That changes the dynamics. It's not just in the prisoner's dilemma, what you do has no effect on what the other person does because it's a one-shot decision. Now you've got this thing about mutual strategies over time, how that can induce at least some level of cooperation. Yeah, Lachelle.
It becomes immensely more complicated, though, when it's not just two people in a game
right.
playing each other. And so I'm curious to see how that would...
So this is what's called... This is another way of complicating the story. A two-person game versus an N-person game. Now, the usual simplifying assumption for the first approximation of an N-person game is me versus everybody else. Since, from a decision-making point of view, I control my decisions, but not the others. And we've treated the others as binary. They either... Everybody cooperates or nobody cooperates. But of course, it's a certain percentage who cooperate and a certain percentage who don't. And that then becomes another form of this, another game. You can have a game that in which your action depends upon the proportion of others that behave in a certain way rather than all or nothing. We will we'll get to that possibility after the break, when we talk about conditional altruism, because that's exactly where this issue comes into play. Yeah.
I was just wondering if Axelrod's research came up with some mathematical explanation for why one particular strategy won in iterated scenarios versus a single scenario, if that tells us anything about individual self-interest versus aggregate self-interest?
It doesn't tell us anything about individual versus aggregate self-interest because it's still individuals deciding on their strategies. And they're still just trying to maximize their own return, their own gain. So his framework is entirely selfish individuals, but now they're maximizing over time rather than just maximizing instantaneously. It's easy enough to show why it becomes a different problem when it's over time rather than because there are more consequences to your actions, and you have to then calculate all these consequences. The problem that the individual faces when it's over time is that that chain of consequences of your choices depends upon the strategies of other people and not just yours. In the prisoner's dilemma, actually, in a way, you're independent of the other person, because whatever the other person does, the best thing to do is defect. Right? So in the, you don't have to know what the other person is likely to do. It doesn't matter. Whatever they do, you should defect. That's why it creates this paradox. But in the iterated game, it does matter what the other people do. So if you knew for sure that everybody else was an unconditional cooperator, and you were just interested in your own payoff, then being a universal defector would be the best strategy. But it wouldn't be the best strategy if the other person was themselves a tit-for-tatter. If they were a tit-for-tatter, you would be better playing tit-for-tat than playing universal defection. That is, you would actually do better over time if you played tit-for-tat, if you knew that they were going to be a tit-for-tatter. And in the Axelrod setup, though, is you don't know what they're going to do. You have to create a strategy that's going to work the best on average against all the possible strategies of others. And that's where it turns out that, just as an empirical matter with his 100 or so game theorists, the simple tit-for-tat strategy, which has the character of having a punishment that you impose on the other actor if they defect, but it's forgiving, because it doesn't punish them forever, right? So that kind of punishment and forgiveness, I mean, that's how he describes it. That turns out to be, on average, the best strategy of any of the strategies that anybody came up with, at least in his simulated tournaments. It also corresponds then with a kind of cultural evolutionary point of view of why it is that tit for tat, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, that is such a common sense proportionality principle. You know, it has this character of imposing harm on others if they impose harm on you, but not if they don't. So it embodies that as a kind of precept, embodies what turns out to be a rational, selfish strategy. And I think probably in the kind of trial and error of cultural evolution probably explains in part why that intuition, tit for tat, does seem a reasonable one. And I think it's true that all cultures have some version of that, some notion of retaliation for harms done. You know, the turn the other cheek is a much more complicated view about how you deal with defection is the ideal of turn the other cheek. Let's take our break, reconvene at 20 after, and we'll turn to what I think is the most important category for the solidarity problem, that is the assurance game and conditional altruism. So I was just asked whether Axelrod's name was really Axelrod. It's actually Robert Axelrod, as opposed to his first name being Axel and his surname being Rod. All right, let's turn to collective action with rational, non-selfish agents. So the premise of the free rider problem is that the preference ordering for the cooperation defection 2x2 table is BADC. There's no reason, however, for people necessarily to have such radically preference orderings. And I think the most important non-selfish preference ordering is one where people really have as their highest preference that everybody cooperate. This could be for two kinds of reasons. One argument is that people gain positive benefit from other people's well-being. So when you think about families, that's typically the way you think about it, is that parents' payoff matrix is not simply what they get out of something. They really care about the well-being of their children. And So whether something is good for their children matters to their own well-being. So that's what's called interdependent utility functions in economics. It means that your welfare depends upon the welfare of others. And if the welfare of others is maximized through mutual cooperation, that would be your highest preference. Because you don't want to benefit at other people's expense, because you don't want other people to do less well than they would otherwise do. So one reason is you actually value the well-being of others. Another reason is a strictly moral reason, that you're a Kantian. You believe in the categorical imperative. You believe it is simply wrong to free ride on other people's efforts. Not because you particularly care about them. It's not because you feel an identification with their well-being. It's just that you've adopted a moral principle that says that it's wrong to impose costs on other people by free riding on their sacrifices. Yeah.
Is this sort of like a Kantian type?
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly what it is. That's the and sometimes in discussions there's a blurring of this distinction between interdependent utility and Kantian preferences. The Kantian preferences are stronger. They're stronger because they apply to all sorts of contexts where you don't have any particular connection to the welfare of others. Kantian principles apply to free riding on the sacrifices of strangers, not just people for whom you are in embedded relations. Typically, as in a kind of empirical matter, I think it's the case that the Kantian moral codes get strengthened by interdependencies of utility. I think these work together. The strongest forms in which you prefer cooperation are where you both care about other people and you feel a strong sense of obligation, where the two go together. But most parents are concerned about the well-being of their children, not because they've been socialized into moral obligation about their children, it's because they love their children. Right? So love is an alternative, if you will, to moral principle. In the sense that loving someone, you don't need to be reminded, oh yeah, it's my obligation to cooperate. And, you know, it's because you care about them. There's a real fusion of your utility functions, if you will. The economists have an easier time with that, because that simply means that the self in the selfish interest get expanded. That it's a misdescription of who the self is in self-interest to say it's the single parent, the single person who's the parent, as opposed to the family. That is the parent's sense of who their self is, encompasses their children. But they're acting in just as ruthlessly self-interested a way. It's just that the self includes this other person. That's easier for economists to deal with, right? You can see it's just redefining the unit of analysis. Whereas the Kantian moral principle really says there's a whole different calculus going on here. Obligations are just not the same as self-interested calculations. I think both of these are ways of thinking about this. I don't have a strong view as to which of these are most important. But the crucial question is that with respect to our collective action problem, it implies a changing of the preference orders from BADC to ABDC. The highest preference is mutual cooperation. That's what you prefer. If you're a Kantian who also cares about the well-being of others, your second preference is going to be individual defection, because actually the chances of the collective action succeeding, which is a good thing for everybody else, is greater than either of the other two options. So it's a little tricky to know exactly what the second preference is in the conditional altruism case. The crucial thing is that the first preference is universal cooperation. I tend to think that if you're being really careful about this, probably your second preference is that you defect and everybody else cooperates, because actually that's better for everybody else than if everybody defects. And nobody's interest is served by you being a universal unilateral cooperator, then you just screw yourself and nobody else benefits. That's not to anybody's advantage. So probably A, B, D, C is the preference ordering for a moral actor, since a moral actor cares about the outcome, at least if they're a consequentialist. An unconditional altruist has as their preferences A, C, B, D. That is, an unconditional altruist will cooperate regardless of what anybody else does. Their first preference is that everybody cooperates. Their second preference is that they be a martyr. You know, they're going to cooperate no matter what. They're just not going to do the uncooperative thing. That's the unconditional altruist. The conditional altruist, I think A, B, D, C is probably the way to think about it. Okay, that's conditional altruism. Now, what Elster argues is that conditional altruism is the central preference ordering of solidarity. That's really what's going on in solidarity. The conditional altruist preference ordering doesn't reduce the cost from unilateralism, that is, from being a sucker. So even without the free rider problem, it's still the case that you don't want to be a unilateral cooperator. You don't want to stick your neck out if nobody else is going to stick their neck out. You don't want to go to the barricades and be hung out to dry, right? You know, so people don't want to be a sucker. But people's, what they really want to do is cooperate with everyone else as long as they're confident that others will cooperate as well. As long as they have assurance that enough other people will cooperate that they won't be a sucker. So this is where the big N comes in, you know, the N person game. You don't literally have to say the condition for my participating is that everyone else participate. What you say is the condition for my participation is that enough other people participate that I'm not a sucker. I don't want to unilaterally make sacrifices for no purpose. So enough other people have to participate so that there is a, you know, reasonable chance that this collective action will have some positive effects. But I'm going to do my bit if enough other people do their bit. The conditionality of conditional altruism, the word conditional, therefore, refers to conditional upon the participation of others, and that is a variable, how conditional it is. And this creates an incredibly interesting research agenda, really an important and fascinating thing. And turns out to be very explanatory for how social movements work, for how collective action works, how class formations work. So let's imagine the following. We have a population of workers. There's a small group of unconditional altruists. That is, they're prepared to make sacrifices for the collective good of working class interests, unconditional on the behavior of others. They're activists. There's a few of them. They get together. They find each other. And they decide, yes, we don't know what's going to happen, but we're going to form the nucleus of a political party, of a union, of a social movement, and try to recruit others. So these are the political entrepreneurs, if you will, the unconditional altruists, the hardcore cadre of a movement, who are prepared to make sacrifices and are prepared to be martyrs. So they don't call it being a sucker. They considered standing up for principle. Then there's another circle of people who are prepared to join a movement and make sacrifices so long as they know there's a core of cadre who are firmly committed. Right? So there's another circle of people whose conditionality is pretty low, that they're not prepared to just risk everything without other people cooperating, but they don't need 50% of the workers in a factory or in a community to join the movement. They just need to be sure that there's at least a core of diehards, of really committed, unconditionally committed activists. So this second circle might be a couple of percent of the population. Then there's another circle of people who will join a movement as long as they feel that there's somewhere around 5% of others who join. And then there's a third circle that will join as long as they see 20, 25% of people joining. And then there's an outer circle that will only join if they see a majority of people joining. Now, depending upon the percentage of people in each of these circles, you can get a snowball going. You can get rapid escalation because you trigger the participation of other conditional altruists who are prepared to join movements so long as there's lots of other people already joining. It's not just conformity at issue. It's a question of how much confidence do they need as about the likely success of the movement before they feel that it triggers their obligation not to be a free rider. So some people believe it's wrong to be a free rider on a movement that's sure to succeed, but it's okay to be a free rider on a movement that has very little chance of succeeding, even if you'd like to see it succeed. And the more people who join a movement, the more likely it is to succeed. And some people will join only when they think it's likely to succeed, but not because they're opportunists who are just out to, you know, get some advantage because it'll be successful. No, it's because their conditionality says, that really means I will be a free rider if I don't join, and I'm not going to be a free rider. But they have a higher threshold to be convinced that the movement is likely to be successful, and therefore that they have an obligation to be part of it. Whereas they don't feel an obligation to be part of a movement that has virtually no chance of success, even if they support its goals. So you can see why it's not so clear you're being a free rider on a movement that you think has no chance of success, because you think the people in it are wasting their time. And you don't have an obligation to waste your time. You have an obligation to participate in something from which you would benefit if it's, you know, if it succeeds, but only if it succeeds has some plausible chance. And that's why this individual calculation gets really complicated, because the probability of something succeeded depends upon what the bands of these participation thresholds are. This in the sociology literature is known as the theory of the critical mass. The theory of the critical mass. It's a very powerful, I think, set of ideas. It combines strong notions of rationality. People are acting rationally. They're not making miscalculations. They're not acting out of wishful thinking. But without the restrictive notions that they're only in it for themselves, that they do feel moral obligations, they do feel Kantian norms about not being a free rider. But then they have different thresholds which trigger those norms leading to their behavior versus other norms. So this theory of the critical mass, I think, is crucial, and it's what Elster argues is really going on in solidarity. Working class solidarity is not the glue of it, is not mainly people who are unconditionally cooperators in collective action. It's people who are prepared to do their bit so long as they see other people doing their bit. Now, in a collective action problem where this is the case, you then get some really other interesting phenomena going on. And one of the interesting things centers around information. So, if you're in a situation where everybody is prepared to join a collective action, so long as 50% of the group participates. But everybody believes that. But there's nobody who will participate if only 10% do. You could then have a situation where you don't get any participation because you can't hit that trigger point, even though everybody would do it if 50% did. Right? Now that's an information failure, because if everybody knew that everybody would do it if 50% did, if everybody had that knowledge, then they'd all participate because they know that everybody's going to participate because everybody is above the necessary threshold for that group. But there's no way of incrementally getting there through this snowball process. You have to have some other solution to the process. You need some other solution to solve this information problem. And that's where the expression assurance, you know, to be assured. You cooperate if you're assured, if you have assurance. It's not insurance, it's assurance. It's an assurance game. Class solidarity will be high if indeed it's the case that conditional altruism is the key. Class solidarity will be high when the preference ordering of most people is conditional altruism, and if the information conditions are present so that people have pretty good information about how other people act. One of the things which gives people good information about the character and values and moral sentiment of other people is if they live and work together in constant conditions of interaction and interdependency, and they stay put. If you have low geographical mobility and high levels of interdependence in large factories, workers get to know each other. They see how people act when there's micro conflicts on the shop floor. They see who comes to whose defense. They get a sense of what the cultural expectations are of in not what people say in the bar, but what they do in practice, in the inevitable conflicts that occur in the small scale. And that's why stable working class communities with relatively low geographical mobility, people aren't constantly coming and going, you don't have constant strangers joining the work teams whose inner motives you don't know, and why class solidarity is higher in such communities than in communities that are where people come and go, where this kind of dense information generating process is weak. Yeah?
Okay, so I have two questions. This sounds like it sort of relates to the social capital in the area. I mean, I don't know, it seems sort of similar, but what does, let's say you have a factory or something like that, but it's, there's a lot of racial divisions or something like that.
Right.
So would you say then that would, even though they might interact and work next to each other and there's low mobility and stuff like that, those sort of divisions would influence the capacity for
actually
having a successful
movement? So, yeah, so, and this I think shows the usefulness of these kinds of ways of thinking. So, and it's a really interesting thing to think about. How does racism impact this? Does racism mainly affect the information problem? That is, there's so many communication problems across that line that people just don't trust each other. Because you know, the word trust and assurance are very closely connected. You trust other people because you believe they will come through in a pinch. You know, you have confidence in their action when push comes to shove. You know, when you have conflicts that are going to be costly for people, they're going to stand solid with you. So one possibility is that racism fractures trust. Another is it just fractures the information about trust. People would be perfectly trustworthy, but you just don't know it. It could also be that it fractures the interdependent utility functions. Right? So remember I said that these two anchors to a conditional altruism, the interdependence of utilities, you're feeling that these are my comrades, these are my friends, these are the people whose lives I care about. And that anchors the moral commitment. I think the two go together. As I said in the discussion of race, there's this added interesting feature specific that's not unique to race, but it's certainly intense around race, which has to do with the way kinship gets built in communities. And then the way fictive kinship becomes a way of people thinking about their relationships more generally. You know, union brothers. I mean, now it's brothers and sisters, but this kind of family metaphor for the way you think about solidarity is certainly real, and race has a very salient play within kinship. That's a lot of what racism, where it gets its specificity, at least that's how I think about it. So that these would be all ways in which race would interfere with conditional altruism being played out as actual solidarity. And I don't know the answer to the question whether it's mainly information or whether it's mainly interdependent utility. People just don't feel the empathy and the sense of connection with the lives of the other people to be included in the moral universe around which the Kantian norms then kick in. The experience in working class communities of minorities being brought in as strike breakers, now that is part of the historical experience of how racism is used, that is a fracturing of conditional altruism. These are anti-cooperators who have been used as anti-cooperators. And then the question is, how much a role does that legacy play in the ongoing sense of suspicion and concern? The inequalities between African American and white working class communities in terms of historic discrimination, this is not such a factor, I think, in the present, but it certainly was in the past, meant that wage competition from recent African American migrants to the north from the south, wage competition was that they were prepared to take much lower wages for the same jobs than whites were, which then acted as a source of division, where then there wasn't a sense of common interests, and then that affects your expectations about their behavior on solidarity grounds. Okay. Collective action with irrational agents. Now, I think this is certainly a relevant ingredient in a full bore theory. I don't think it's at the core of the notion of solidarity. We're going to discuss the question of irrationality in the theories of ideology, in the ways in which ideologies cultivate irrationality of various ways. There's a whole sort of menu of forms of irrationality that figure in questions of class struggle, ideology formation. An example would be wishful thinking. Wishful thinking are forms of irrationality which affect people's estimation of the likely costs of participation, subjectively underestimating the probability of being killed or wounded, for example. You know, there's this general view that young men, especially young testosterone-fueled men, underestimate the risks of all sorts of risky activities, and that it's basically irrational if they actually realized how risky what they were doing and what the consequences were of it, they wouldn't do things, but they basically discount risks for all sorts of reasons. That's different from saying that they fully understand the risks, but simply decide it's not important. That's not irrational. It's not irrational to engage in risky behavior if you accurately estimate the risks and decide, yes, I know this is risky, it might kill me, but I'm still willing to take the chance because the payoff is so big. When people underestimate the risks and overestimate the payoffs, then they're engaging in irrational behavior. And wishful thinking is an example of that. But we'll talk about the irrational side of this later. Let me just, to wrap this up, briefly talk about these social conditions for solidarity. So let's take conditional altruism as the pivot. That's the way we are going to think about what solidarity is. Solidarity is a solution to the free rider problem. It's a solution to collective action. It creates collective action. When it is the case that the preferences of the actors are conditional altruist rather than selfish, and that's for a combination of Kantian and interdependent utility reasons. It's because people care about each other's welfare and they accept the moral norms that they have obligations to the collectivity. So both are operating. That's the preference side of it. And they have good enough information about other people that they feel confident to act on those preferences. So those are the two ingredients. What then does this tell us about the social conditions for solidarity? And there are three things that I think are relevant here. I've mentioned at least two of them a little bit. One is a very classical Marxian idea about the importance of the concentration and interdependence of workers in explaining the transition from a condition in which workers simply are defined by occupying these locations in the class structure to workers being formed as collective actors. Marx referred to this as the transformation from being a class in itself to a class for itself. That's the classic Marxian terminology for this process. Marx emphasized the importance of the increasing concentration of workers in large factories and their growing interdependence in the labor process as being two key things which affect class formation. And he contrasted workers to peasants on precisely these grounds. Peasants, he regarded, probably unfairly, this was probably sort of bad sociology in a way, but nevertheless, theoretically it's perfectly fine as a way of characterizing the contrast. He described peasants as a sack of potatoes. Each potato remains separate. That, you know, so that the capacity, in his view, for collective action of peasants was extremely limited because they worked in small plots. They didn't work in a highly interdependent division of labor, typically. At least the European peasants that he was focusing on when he made those comments. It was France that he was making the comments. So they're small holders. They work on their separate plots. They share common enemies, bankers, grain dealers. They had common opponents, but they had tremendous capacity forming coherent, sustained collective action because they weren't gathered in large bodies and they didn't have ongoing daily interdependence. Well, he was cavalier about that. It turns out not to be so true in all cases. There are plenty of cases where peasants do manage to form collective actions. But I think the point is still well taken. Marx wrote that competition separated individuals from one another, not only the bourgeoisie, but still more the workers, in spite of the fact that it brings them together. So competition divides workers, bringing them into large factories, creating a labor process of interdependency, connects them to each other. And it bears on the conditional altruism phenomenon on both dimensions of conditional altruism. It provides much better information. Workers get to know each other. They have much better information about the likely behavior of others when they're in large factories, interdependent. And it changes their preferences because their very interdependency, their reliance on each other, makes them feel that their own self is connected to the selves of others. The interdependency is a stretching of the self in the self-interest. You get the interdependent utilities, in the kind of economist way of talking about it, and the information problem solved. Bringing people together in large factories doesn't itself explain anything about where the moral codes of conditional altruism, as Kantians come from. I think that gets cultivated by the collective action itself. That is, when unions get formed, when struggles occur, a language of moral responsibility and obligation very quickly becomes part of the language with which people come to think of their participation. Okay, second point is community. I mentioned that a little bit already as well. The stability of working class communities bears strongly on the conditions for solidarity. In the United States, one of the hallmarks of American history throughout American history is huge geographical mobility, way more than in most European contexts. The percentage of people who grow up and live in the same neighborhoods their whole lives has always been lower here than elsewhere. That, I think, is one of the ingredients that undermines solidarity. Moving around a lot undermines historical memory. One of the things which builds a sense of connection, of interdependence, is the knowledge of past struggles. And that gets scrambled by geographical mobility. I think this is also where issues of racism and ethnic heterogeneity would bear. There's a very interesting study done by a sociology grad student here in the early 80s, Al Geddix, about Finnish mining communities in northern Wisconsin around the question of building solidarity in community. So the Finnish mining communities were extremely radical. The Finns were the immigrant population in Wisconsin with the highest percentage of communists of any immigrant group, more than Jews. So Jews are thought of as in New York as having a high concentration of communists in the first half of the first third of the 20th century. Actually, Finns were by far the had the highest density of communists. The Finns in northern Wisconsin organized, they had a Finnish language newspapers. They organized Slovenian and Italian and other language newspapers of other ethnic groups as a way of building solidarity across ethnic groups. They saw the problem of ethnic division as critical and the need to create interdependency and mutual dependency on each other as crucial to building class solidarity in the mining communities. And were pretty successful, apparently, in doing that. So I don't know if any of you are of Finnish extraction at all, but the Finns have a very honorable class struggle history in Wisconsin. Finally, leadership, activists, and organization. Marxists, particularly, I think, since Lenin, have always argued for the importance of formal organization and leadership in class struggle, as opposed to taking a spontaneous view about how struggles take place. It's not just the upwelling of anger and collective organization. It requires leadership and cadre, committed activists to provide for collective action. Now, Elster argues that in addition to the obvious reasons, so there's some trivial reasons why that's true. You know, you need continuity, you need somebody to put out the newspapers, you know, so that people who treat this as a major core of their life's work are needed to solve all sorts of practical problems of organization. But Elster argues that there's another crucial question, which is the way leadership can solve and help solve the information problems of conditional altruism. To quote him, this is, if you want to make a note, it's from page 366 of Making Sense of Marx. If one individual knows and is trusted by 100 people, he, quote, can create the information conditions by 200 transactions. So if one individual knows and is trusted by 100 people, 200 transactions are needed to communicate this to everybody. First by asking each of them about their willingness to join the collective action and then telling each about the willingness of everyone else. By contrast, bilateral communication between the 100 will require 5,000 acts of communication. That's just a kind of simple mathematical point. The information gains from leadership can be quite substantial. That's what Elster emphasizes, is that leadership, you know, and this mathematical example is just meant to be a stark way of showing that that leadership can help solve this crucial information problem about the willingness to act of everybody in a particular circle that enables people who don't know each other to have higher levels of confidence in other people's willingness to act than they would if they had to only rely on their private information that they got from their own interactions with others. And that's a key part of the way in which class solidarities get built up. Leadership can also help the targeting of the snowball problem. Remember, there are these bands of actors with different levels of trigger points. Well, leadership can get the kind of information about where the target groups that have different thresholds are. And therefore, the activity of mobilization can proceed in a more coherent way than in the absence of that kind of information. All right, well, that's conditional altruism, solidarity. The next two sessions, one will be on the dilemmas of collective action, and the last on the problem of class compromise.